From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys for this week. You got myself, Stuart, here over in Melbourne, Australia, the land of Andrews. Idiot Daniel Andrews, that is. Never mind him, he's an arsehole. Anyway, over to my... That side there is Mr. Hunter Doozing in Dallas, Texas.
Hello.
Hey, brother. As you can see, those of you watching or those of you hearing, we'll soon find out there is no John this week. Mm-hmm. One of those rare times when he's clocked in late, as they say.
So usually it's me that's like, oh, I thought it was tomorrow.
Usually it's me saying, oh, I can't make it this week. Can you guys go with it? So, yeah. Anyway, so no John this week, but we do have an announcement. No, we'll do it now, I guess, about what's coming up in September. Before we get into our whip out your junk section.
Everybody who listens to this show will be so excited.
It's going to be fun.
Not surprised at all. I can't wait.
No. So anyway, as you know, we've been speaking about for the last, two years or so, about Rob Zombie's The Munsters coming out. Now, it's coming out in late September. Obviously, you know, we're doing it and we're having Garrow on, of course. Anyway, a little while back, maybe about a month ago or so, I sort of thought, what about a Munsters Month? As in Munsters, M-U-N-T-H, Munsters Month. So instead of just having it as one episode with just Garrow for the Rob Zombie film, let's do a whole month of Munsters. So we're going to be doing 4 weeks. September is Munsters Month. So there'll be week one will be two episodes of The Munsters, which we've already got picked out. We're going to be reviewing along with an episode of The Munsters Today and the ill-fated pilot film from 2013, I think it is, or 2012, Mockingbird Lane, which was only one episode and it disappeared. Yeah. Week two will be Munster Go Home, the feature film from 1966. Week three will be The Munsters Revenge, the TV movie from 1981. And week four will be Rob Zombie's The Munsters. But for all 4 weeks, we're going to have Garrow on for all of them. So not just the last one. And I thought, you know what? We haven't had Garrow on for a while. We've had requests to have him on. So instead of just for the last one, let's ask him if he can join us for all four. And he said, yeah, definitely. So we've been hatching a plan behind the scenes. And yeah, we're gonna be doing this, getting this thing done. So I anticipate, don't hold me to this, as the wind here goes berserk in Melbourne, that it'll be dropped around the 7th, 14th, 21st, and 28th of September. Don't hold me to that. They will be close to those dates. But there will be four episodes of various incantations of the Munsters. We are not doing Here Comes the Munsters from 1995, I think it was, or a bit later, or we're not doing Munsters Scary Little Christmas. Okay, there's a lot of Munsters stuff out there. Nor are we doing the animated series, the long-lost animated series. We just sort of picked some.
It'll be like Rock Month where there's enough to do it every year.
Pretty much, yeah. Don't ask us next September to do another Munsters Month. Yeah. You do Adam's Family Month? No. It's only because this zombie film's coming out. Oh. And we want to give it a fighting chance by saying, you know what? We know it's going to be crap. But let's give it a fighting chance up against the Munsters Today, which I've seen. And believe me, oh man, that cheese done stink. It's not good at all.
We can really rank our Munsters content, you know? the best,
yeah.
Which is obviously the TV show, but still.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it should be fun. And yeah. Something we're really looking forward to doing. And, you know, yes, on YouTube there's going to be a ton of Munsters review for the Rob Zombie film, but doing what we're doing, I don't think there will be. So, yeah. Another unique product from the MMC. So, having said that, that's that announcement out of the way. Munsters Month in September. Okay. Anything you want to say, boss?
I guess let's go to the next segment. Let's whip out our junk.
Okay. Well, I'll whip out my junk, and it's nowhere. I've got nothing this week. Literally.
Got nothing.
Nope.
Okay.
So, it's all over to you.
You know, I had something on here, but I wanted John to comment on it, so I'm saving it for when he's on. But first up, this is a bad movie. Cursed. Wes Craven's Cursed.
Yeah.
Which just got a special edition from Scream Factory. You know, this is obviously not a good movie. It's directed by Wes Craven, who I'm a big fan of, and Kevin Williamson wrote it allegedly, but it's like he wrote a script and then it was just rewritten into nothing. But a very troubled production. In fact, like, you know, there is allegedly an alternate cut out there, but I don't think it has an ending. I don't think it's ever going to come out. You know, this is as good as a home video release you're going to get, but I got it because I'm a Wes Craven fan. I remember seeing this in the theater and being hugely disappointed. But yeah. Next one, much better movie, one we've actually done on the show, The Octagon on Blu-ray from Kino Lorber.
Yeah.
Got that reversible cover.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, with Chuck Norris and Lee Van Cleef, directed by Eric Carson. Yeah, what else can you say? And a movie.
Hey,
that
hang on,
watched...
hang on. It's not what else can you say. It's what else can you say? Can you say? Can you say?
Can you say? Yeah, the ninja. speaking of ninjas, this was a movie I watched a lot as a kid. I have no idea if it holds up. Probably not. But when I was, you know, kind of on a old 90s ninja kick.
Three Ninjas?
No, close. I did watch that a few weeks ago.
Okay.
Surf Ninjas.
Oh, boy.
With Ernie Reyes Jr. It's got Rob Schneider and Leslie Nielsen.
And oh, boy.
This kid right here, he's got a Game Gear that can predict the future. You know, so.
Wow.
But yeah. Very much a 90s product of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and all that stuff. But when I was a kid, I thought it was a great... It was in the regular rotation with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Three Ninjas and Home Alone and whatever else, you know.
Yep. What about...
That's
it
for me.
That's... Yeah, okay. Is that a trauma film? No. No. What am I thinking of? Surf Nazis Must Die.
Yeah. Similar cover. No, this was New Line Cinema put this out. Very much a New Line product.
Yeah. I remember there was a film called Johnny Tsunami. You ever heard of it?
Yeah, I've heard of it. I don't think I've seen it, though.
Anyway, so it was available to buy. You know, it wasn't a premium title, but it was available to buy. Then there was the tsunami that happened in Thailand, I think it was, or one of those other foreign countries where 250,000 people got killed. Then the film disappeared. Yeah, it was just guilt by association of the title alone. So
it's amazing how that happens. Just a world event can sink your film, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but...
Shame.
Actually, speaking of that, I was listening to the Bloodhound Gang last night. And that hefty fine album,
you know,
is
as
not
one
good.
Does.
Yeah, of course. As at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're driving home, you listen to the Bloodhound Gang coming home from work.
You're listening to Asleep at the Wheel, right?
No. Oh, that is actually, I have started noodling around on a program I've got and doing a ranking the albums of just things that run about 10 minutes or so. I do want to do a Bloodhound Gang one. Because there's only 5 albums in there, so it's pretty quick to get through.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I was listening to one, and Jimmy Pop was making references to planes disappearing like 9/11. I thought, oh man,
wow.
Yeah, he's
You know, and I think there's a reason that band only toured Eastern Europe towards the end of their life.
Yeah. I'll say they are the one band who will reference pop culture more than anybody, or better than anybody, I should say, in their songs.
They have they're probably the only like rock hip hop group that has a reference to Up All Night with Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah. And the drummer from Def Leppard's only got one arm. I remember that song causing a real stink when it came out.
Yeah.
I thought, well, it's actually pretty funny, you know, because it is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of funny songs, you know. And man, like when Hooray for Boobies came out, like they had, you know, they were on like Jackass, you know, they were everywhere for a minute.
Yeah. That was like when I was watching Danny Bonaducci actually used to do a segment here on television. The entertainment segment. It was actually pretty funny. The show was awful, but it was actually quite funny. He made a joke once about there's a new game show out hosted by the drummer from Def Leppard and Heather Mills McCartney called I Can't Believe This Cost an Arm and a Leg.
Oh my gosh.
They just, oh, you can't say that. That's funny as shit. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
Oh man. Yeah. Give me back that un-PC humor any day. Anyway. So if, is that you, bot? You're done, boss?
Yeah, I'm done.
Yep.
That's it.
Okay. So, yep. We'll move on to the film we're talking about this week for this week's episode. And that is, a film I saw in theaters played 1 week. That was it. Gone.
Yeah.
Saw the poster.
Shocking.
Not shocking. Desperate Hours, starring Mickey Rourke, Kelly Lynch, Mimi Rogers, and the very pale, ashen-faced Anthony Hopkins. Give me... You're over, Bosworth! It's all done! You're finished!
All done.
Oh,
oh man. The Anthony Hamkins.
And Shawnee Smith, which I think is the reason why I went and saw this film when I did, because I really liked her in the Blob remake. And yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The posters were around. I said, okay... I went on a Friday night. I'd finished work because films start here on a Thursday. So I went in, bought my ticket, saw it at the Village Cinemas on Bourke Street. Watched it, enjoyed it then, recommended it to someone. It's gone. I'm like, oh, it was out. My mate goes, it's gone. It's not playing anywhere.
Yeah. It flopped. It cost $18 million and it only made 2.7 in the US.
Ooh. And international
Michael Cimino's his last handful of movies like just tanked one after the other. And you know, everyone talks about Heaven's Gate, but his last few movies just they were modestly budgeted and they didn't do any business, you know.
But Heaven's Gate had the notorious reputation as being a troubled project.
Oh yeah, yeah. There was the cost and expense, and you know one of the reasons it attracted so much bad press was that Michael Cimino would not allow any press anywhere near the set. He came off as hostile, and so then people from the press went in undercover as, I think, extras and were taking pictures and reporting all sorts of nefarious things that were kind of blown out of proportion. But, you know, it did a lot of damage to the movie. You know, but, you know, Michael Cimino, who directed this film, this was his second to last film. And it didn't do any business. It did very poorly, but it recently got a Blu-ray release here in the US.
Yep, which is when you showed it the other week. I thought, be interesting to revisit that. Did I go out and buy the Blu-ray release upon seeing you having it? I thought I'd wait till I watched the film, and I'm glad I held off.
Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to be watching this one again, but and I'm a Michael Cimino fan, okay? I like, you know, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. It's a great movie.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
You know, I haven't seen The Deer Hunter since I was in college. I actually meant to watch it again for this show, but as you know, my life got pretty crazy and I wasn't able to. But I like Heaven's Gate.
Never seen it. Still never seen it.
You know, I saw it on DVD, I think in college or maybe shortly thereafter. And I remember thinking it was really long and I didn't really enjoy it. But Criterion did a restoration of it on Blu-ray and it's, and then you go, oh, I can see the movie. Like,
oh, okay.
The way it looked before, just it had this yellow tint. It just didn't look very good. And I know like people give Criterion a lot of crap for kind of letting their directors go back and mess with stuff. But no one complained when they did that to Heaven's Gate because you can see it looks incredible.
Okay.
You know, and I really became a fan of it after seeing the Criterion Blu-ray of it. I love Year of the Dragon. I think that's a tremendous movie.
Yeah, I need to revisit it. I own it. It's on the shelf, but I've never not seen it in years and years and years.
Yeah.
And years.
But that's a good one. Yeah, but, you know. The Sicilian director's cut it's okay. I did an episode on that, on low res. But yeah, you know, the only one of his I haven't seen is Sun Chaser, the one he did after this.
No. What year was that?
Oh gosh. I want to say it was 96. So 6 years after this movie.
And when did he pass away? What year did he die?
2015.
Wow, so he was inactive for nearly 20 years.
Yeah, you know, Cimino wasn't completely inactive. He did write novels.
Okay.
In France.
Does that count?
He was like, I think, you know, I think the French loved him, so he did a lot of stuff there. Like, I think the last thing he actually directed was like a promo for a film festival. I can't remember which one, but you know, he wrote novels that were translated into French, and he had a few projects that he was trying to get made, but nothing ever came of it. And, but yeah, he was inactive for that long as far as directing movies goes.
Okay.
He didn't make anything since 96.
Except the complete mess of his face.
Yeah. Cimino, you know, there was a lot of ink spilled about, you know, it is like the star of this movie, Mickey Rourke.
Mm-hmm.
Like he just, at a certain point, I remember Michael Cimino, he's kind of like the Vinnie Vincent of film. you know, because Michael Cimino he has this reputation as being a recluse and kind of an oddball. But, you know, towards the end of his life, Cimino was doing a lot of interviews. He was doing DVD and Blu-ray commentaries. You know, he did the Criterion restoration for Heaven's Gate. He was doing a lot of stuff. And like Vinnie Vincent, who was in Kiss, did Vinnie Vincent Invasion and just disappeared.
Yep.
You know, the metal press would be like, we found his house and there's a lot of dead cats in the house. You
in
know,
Tupperware
like lots
box.
Of...
Yeah, in freezers in Tupperware, yeah.
Yeah, like weird stuff. But then eventually Vinnie Vincent and everybody in Kiss is like, we hope he's dead, you know? You know, we hate this
we
guy.
Don't want another lawsuit from this guy.
Yeah. I think Gene Simmons did do a vault experience with him.
Oh, he's done it with everyone. I think he's done one with me. I just don't remember it.
You know, one time I showed up, I was like, hey, I'm here with Gene Simmons for the vault experience. and Gene's like, I would like you to have this man arrested.
Yeah.
Post haste. But Vinny reemerged looking like he was a woman.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And everybody was like, is Vinnie Vincent transitioning? What's going on? Nothing, you know? And Michael Cimino, it's the same thing. Like Michael Cimino, just one day, he had this facelift. His lips were bigger. He always wore sunglasses. You never saw his eyes.
Mm.
And he had like what looked like a wig on, like a red kind of wig. But everybody was going, is he, what's going on with him? You know, I think we, but the thing about Cimino is he was such an enigma. He wouldn't, he gave a lot of contradictory interviews with different information. And you just never knew what was what with this guy. He just, the new biography of him, which I just finished reading, it's called Cimino, The Deer Hunter, Heaven's Gate, and The Price of Vision. It's by Charles Elton.
Worth a read?
He does a lot of, I'm sorry? Yeah, is it's it worth reading. I read it really fast.
Okay.
But it has a lot of good info. I'd like to correct him on a few things. Like he said, Clint Eastwood directed The Beguiled. Clint Eastwood directed a making of The Beguiled, but he didn't direct The Beguiled.
Don Siegel, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was Don Siegel. Mm. Yep. And, but he does a lot of work kind of sorting through the weirdness that is Cimino. Another reason this book is good to read is there's a very famous book called Final Cut by Stephen Bach, who was one of the executives at United Artists in charge of Heaven's Gate. Now, you don't need a history degree to know that this is a conflict of interest for this guy to be giving you the history of Heaven's Gate, because he makes it out like, you know, he's the hero of the story and Michael Cimino is crazy and everybody else is incompetent. But this book does a good job. It doesn't exonerate Cimino or his ego, but it does a good job of kind of pushing back against that narrative and finding other information. It also argues that, you know, what do you hear about when you hear a Heaven's Gate? It's the movie that killed United Artists, right? Well, he goes, that's not really true. Mark Kerkorian, the owner of MGM, walked up to back the Brinks truck up to UA with $365 million or something around that and just said, I like to buy United Artists. And everybody was like, that would be ridiculous to say no to that. You know?
Yeah.
So it wasn't that Heaven's Gate made them go, we have to sell. It's that they got a great offer.
But it sounds good. It sounds good.
And it's sexy. It makes the movie sound worse than it is. It killed the studio, you know. But yeah, The Desperate Hours is, it's actually not, this isn't an original movie. It's actually based on a play, and it was made into a movie with Bogart.
Yep. 55?
Directed by William Wiley. 55, yeah, it was 55.
Like, yeah. Which I've never seen that one still. I'd like to, though.
I wanted to watch it for this show, but life got in the way, unfortunately. But yeah, The Desperate Hours. So you saw this in the theater, Stu.
Yeah.
And did the audience seem to enjoy it? Was it?
I enjoyed it because I was the audience. It was like two people there, me and somebody else further down the front. There was, can't say I really convey or converse with that person. Said, hey, what'd you think of The Desperate Hours? But I mean, I liked it. But of course, I was 18 at the time when I saw this. So, you know, an 18-year-old with raging high testosterone. You got Shawnee Smith, who at that time was nice looking. She's still okay today, I guess. You're thinking, yeah, this film rules. And Mickey Rourke's the embodiment of masculinity. And you see Kelly Lynch on the screen. You think, oh, man. So, you know, you're as a man of 50 now compared to a boy of 18 then, huge difference in perspective on the film itself. But yeah, at the time in 1990 when I saw it, I did enjoy it. I sought it out on... No, I didn't own the Laserdisc of it. I just bought the DVD of it when it got released in the US, which is the one I still got. Got the soundtrack as well on CD by David Mansfield. Really like that soundtrack. Enjoy it.
Yeah. Mansfield was, he's in Heaven's Gate. And he did he did the soundtrack for it too. There's a very famous scene in Heaven's Gate where he is playing the fiddle on roller skates in a roller rink.
Mm.
If you look up like Heaven's Gate on YouTube, it's like one of the first scenes that comes up.
I'll just watch the film. I want to see it.
Yeah, you got to see it. But Mansfield's soundtrack for Heaven's Gate is very highly revered, and I think it's kind of sought after on vinyl.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but I think that's what I remember reading. But he had a weird relationship with Cimino, because Cimino had a producer named Joanne Carelli, who was like this with Cimino, like attached at the hip. She was very mysterious. She was kind of Michael's go-to through person with like the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Like they would have meetings where he would talk to her and she would talk to the executives, like very odd.
Mm.
But she was very like mysterious, didn't do interviews. In fact, like the author of this book got to sit down with her and he was shocked that he did, because she's such a odd duck. But anyway, Michael Cimino and her were maybe dating, maybe not, but whatever their personal relationship is, it must have become muddy, because she ended up getting married to Mansfield while making Heaven's Gate.
Oh.
And Michael Cimino did not know about this, and when people tried to tell him, he just went, "No, she's not. She's not married to him. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? And then they had a daughter together, but Joanne Carelli was like, "Hey, you know, she's with me and Michael." And Michael ended up kind of raising her as like his surrogate daughter. And Mansfield and Carelli got divorced, but there's so many weird personal relationships behind the scenes here. But Mansfield, man. I mean, they must have still had a professional relationship, because he did the music for this.
Mm.
What do you think of the score for this movie?
Really like it a lot.
Yeah,
it's a little derivative, but I mean, what soundtrack isn't these days? What soundtrack, you know, even back then was truly original? There was not many.
Well, you know, I was listening to it and I was going, I don't know if it's right for the material, but it's good music, you know, and it's hard to. These days, you know, when I just think movie music is such a non-entity a lot of times these days. Yeah. You know, there are some good soundtracks here and there, but when you hear one where there's like a lot of musicality going on, like in this one, you're kind of like, oh, that's pretty good, you know.
Yeah. It caught my ears when I was watching. I thought, oh wow, what a cool soundtrack. But it wasn't one I didn't find in stores. It was one I sought much later on, probably like about 2010, I think I found it. It was on Amazon US for a cent. So,
well, and you know, Mansfield, he was in Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder review. Like, you know, he's played with everybody.
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah. He's been around a long time. He's played with Johnny Cash and Dwight Yoakam. Wait, it says here he played with Spinal Tap.
Oh my goodness.
But yeah, that Bob Dylan Rolling Thunder review, that's when he like had his face painted and, you know, had the big band with T-Bone Burnett, who did all the Coen Brothers music.
Okay.
But yeah.
I like it. I mean, I still pop it in the car every so often and think, oh, wouldn't mind hearing the Desperate Hour soundtrack. I think I listen to the Desperate Hour soundtrack more than I do watch the movie. So
yeah. That's probably the best thing artistically to come out of this movie.
I think so. But anyway, let's get into it. Let's get into this ridiculous plot. It is basically Michael Bosworth is a in court on trial for murder, was it?
I think it was murder. Is Mickey Rourke's character.
Mickey Rourke, who is just on the final sort of days of his Mickey Rourke looking face before he became what the hell happened to Mickey Rourke. That happened a little bit later on.
Before he became Marv from Sin City.
Yeah, but literally, yeah, for real. Yeah. Who's a prisoner who is in court up for murder on a murder trial. His lawyer is actually his fiancée or his lover, played by Kelly Lynch. She helps him.
All legs. in this movie.
Boy, and don't they accentuate those? They just go on.
You just see her
and
legs
on.
And like her boobs fly out in every scene she's in for no reason.
Her plastic tennis balls, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, hey, at 18 back in 1990, I would have taken her, but
yeah.
Yeah, but whatever. Anyway, found out, actually looked up Kelly Lynch's height. I had to. I thought she's got to be at least 6'1". No, she's 5'8". So that was well shocked because she's that's shorter than you and I. And I thought, wow, she's packing some legs on that girl.
Mm-hmm.
But so she helps him bust out of the courthouse. They then flee, or Bosworth flees to a waiting getaway car with his brother and this sort of idiot savant driver they got named Albert.
Which two really good character actors. There's Elias Koteas, who people my age will remember as Casey Jones from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Yep.
But he's kind of the poor man. He's kind of like a De Niro type a little bit.
Yeah.
But you see him in a lot of movies. Scorsese even uses him a lot. And Albert is played by David Morse, who's been in a ton of movies. He was in The Green Mile. He played George Washington in the John Adams miniseries for HBO. Trying to see what else. The Hurt Locker. World War Z. 12 Monkeys. Just lots of movies. Like he's a really good Long Kiss Goodnight. The Rock.
Working actor. Good on
him. He's been in a lot of stuff. When I saw him and Elias Koteas, I was like, hey, these are two solid character actors right here.
Yeah. So anyway, they jump into the getaway vehicle and basically cruise on down to find a house to break into and just hide for a while, try and get some money, get some jewelry out of him, until Nancy, played by Kelly Lynch, is able to get down to meet up with Bosworth, Mickey Rourke, and then basically flee over to the, I don't know, they say they're going to Mexico or they're trying to go somewhere, get out of the U.S.
It's really vague. Mm. One of the big problems I have with this movie is I don't understand why we're in the situation we're in. So Mickey Rourke is on the lam and he goes to a really nice neighborhood, goes to a really nice house and with a big freaking family and goes, yeah, I'm going to take these people hostage and hole up here. And I was going, why do you need to do this here?
Mm.
And also, this is a lot to manage for you to just, like, let's just stay here and manage this big family in this big house. Yeah. It just seems like a doomed prop. It just seems like a bad move.
It is. Yeah.
And he's waiting for Kelly Lynch, I guess, because they're together. But it's like, why do we need to wait this long? Why do we need, I didn't feel like there was something driving the tension, for them to be in this house, big, big house. And, a big house can be used for suspense, but it just kind of feels like chaos a little bit. It doesn't feel suspenseful.
When you got a confined space, then you create tension because there's nowhere to run.
Right, and this is based on a play.
Yeah.
So you're getting a confined space in the play, I'm sure.
Of course, yeah. You're not getting a double-story damn near mansion to use.
It's a huge house. Huge. Yeah.
So anyway, Rourke managed to get his way into this house, which is owned by Mimi Rogers, who is, separated from her husband, played by Anthony Hopkins. The house is up for sale. Hopkins has gone his own way with a younger woman who we don't see in the film, but we do hear about. But we get a scene anyway before that, Bosworth goes into and holds the family hostage of the disarray this family is in. Hopkins goes to see his kids. His daughter wants nothing to do with him. She shrugs him off. One thing I noticed, everybody seems to be very, very good at playing the piano in this film, but whatever. They all seem to be a pianist in this. Okay. You just show the disconnect between all the family members. Why you've got that,
I don't know what for the payoff at the end, which they get back together. I'm not spoiling nothing. They get, but you think, oh, we'll give it one more try because you were the man of the house and you managed to save us all. You know, it doesn't really make much sense.
You have to trust me, Nora. Yeah. You have to trust me.
Did you see or did you hear Hopkins' voice waver between Welsh into Southern American, like a deep Ellum, you know, sort of, you're done, Bosworth. And then he sounds Welsh. It was strange. I thought
one of the things about this movie is Mickey Rourke gives a really big performance, you know, and what I read was that Mickey was entering the like Brando phase of his career where he was improvising a lot. He wasn't reading the script. He was changing what he said. And apparently this drove Hopkins nuts because Hopkins is a guy who learns his lines and comes in.
Yep.
But it kind of felt like Hopkins was trying to out-ham Rourke in scenes. Did you get that sense?
Yeah.
His everybody's performance in this is really ticky and kind of like,
yeah, it's just,
oh, it's tension. So I'm like, I'm crazy, you know.
Well, except for the son, because when they do bust into the house, or they find their way into the house, he's playing video games, and two complete strangers are sitting there giving him instructions how to play the game. He's going, he doesn't twig. He doesn't ask, who are you? Until about 30 seconds later, he runs off. Kid, wake up.
Which I thought was so funny that he runs in, turns on the Nintendo, and it's Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. And it's Mike Tyson's Punch-Out for the NES, okay? And David Morse, who's this big goon leg breaker, walks up and starts telling him, you got to go left, right, left, right. And he's like, oh, if you want to get to Tyson, you know, he knows exactly the game he's playing. And he starts telling him how, because that's a game where you have very specific strategies for beating each boxer. But he's like, you got to get to Tyson. If you want to do this, you want to get to Tyson. You got. And the kid's like, wait, that's when the kid gets confused. He's like, this adult knows what.
Even though he didn't twig, there's guys I don't know in my house. And I must say, shame on you video companies these days, because if a kid can run home, turn on a game that quick and it's on straight away, compared to this goddamn PS4 and PS5, which I put on, I'm sitting there, I'm waiting till it loads up with a jingle. Yeah. Come, this one just turns straight on. So,
yeah, the NES does turn straight on, although he goes right into the game, which is not how it works.
No.
You know.
Anyway, it's just basically, for the most part, it's basically feels like a play from there on in, because it's pretty much set in the house.
You get these cutaways to like people chasing Kelly Lynch.
Yeah.
The cops chasing her, shaking her down. Hank from Breaking Bad is one of the FBI guys, giving the exact same performance he gives in Breaking Bad.
We're going to jump about the timeline with this. So,
one
thing that really stood out to me when I watched this film was when they got that operation running in that, what seems like an aircraft hangar, for three fugitive, or one fugitive and two accomplices. We've got this aircraft hangar size thing with publicity headshots on the wall. When does Bosworth sit there and look like a, you know, talent agent headshot 10 or 20 feet high? It's
a freaking banner.
It is a talent
shot hanging down, like in they've got this war room in what looks like an aircraft carrier with these banners to their faces. It is absolutely over the top.
And they've not only got them of Bosworth and his two accomplices, they've got them of the family as well. We've got banners of the family. Yes.
They've all had professional headshots done as well.
It's just strange.
It is really weird. But there is like a weird, you know, this is something that you find in a lot of Cimino's work, is this kind of over the top, like everything's got to look really good. Like, the movie opens with Kelly Lynch tearing through the countryside, and every shot is beautiful. It reminded me of Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, actually. Yeah. And you see these billowing smoke behind the car, and she pulls up at this lake, and it's like the most beautiful, picturesque lake you've ever seen. And she's looking like so sexy in this car in the middle of nowhere.
And then his leg pops straight out. It's about that long.
Yeah. It's,
I mean, it looks good,
totally,
but
crazy.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but there's this, like, it's so over the top that you know, movies have a hyper reality to them that we accept. But in this movie, you're kind of like, whoa, this is too much. Like, another example is one of the guys escapes, the David Morse character.
Yeah.
He leaves the house and he's running around like in Mexico or something. And he comes up from this river onto a road. And what does he find? He's like covered in blood.
Yeah.
And he finds these two girls on the side of the road in Mexico with like hot pants, like beyond
fucking
hot pants.
Hot,
yeah,
man.
They look like strippers. They look like
awesome.
Strippers.
I loved it.
And I was going, what is happening?
This is Cimino having some fun with the camera going, yeah. I'm putting it. Mickey Rourke would have been, I want them two girls on the screen.
Yeah. He's like, hey, Mike, listen, I met these two girls at the strip club last night. I think they'd be really great in the film. And Mike's like, yeah, you know what, Mickey, I think you're onto something here.
Yeah. Mickey Rourke, after the scene, goes, where is my babies?
Where's
my
babies?
They go run to him. He goes, not you, my babies. His little doggies.
his little chihuahuas. Yeah. Man, you know when he made Once Upon a Time in Mexico? Yeah. You know, he went up to Robert Rodriguez and he was like, hey, Robert, you know, I got this idea for my character. You know, he's kind of a gangster, but what if I had him hold like a little chihuahua? What do you think about that? You think that'd be pretty cool? And Robert Rodriguez is just like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah, just don't punch me out, please. Yeah. Do what you want. I know you're a boxer. Yeah, well, don't worry. Go
whatever,
ahead.
Mickey. You do you. You do your thing. Because he's always got his little chihuahua in that movie. And you know this is something that he goes up to every director and he's like, Hey, Darren Aronofsky, you know, I know I'm playing a wrestler, but what if I held a chihuahua during this?
In his contract, we come as a package deal. Me and my babies.
Yes. you know this is a common request because he loves his little chihuahuas.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, that's cool. But yeah, I thought that was really strange about the huge banners for the Bosworth and his brother and for Albert and the family as well. And why do we need an operation that big? It's he's a dangerous criminal. We understand that.
Yeah.
But
it's all
you are wasting resources.
Well, everything in this movie is over the top. Like it's really everything's cranked up to 10. Like, you know, like I said, everybody's trying to out ham each other in the acting, right? Except maybe the kids. But another thing is when you get there's a shootout at the end and like the FBI freaking lights up the house. Everyone's inside. The hostages are inside. Everybody's inside the house, but they're treating it like it's the Waco freaking compound. Like,
yeah, I know. Like the ATF are there after.
And of course, nobody gets hurt except I was watching that going, they're going to kill everyone. But it's just the movie, the way it approaches everything is huge, over the top, big.
Yeah.
You know,
big and loud. You mentioned about the kids. Lennon Moulton was not a fan of this film. And his assessment of Shawnee Smith was Shawnee Smith seems like the daughter any father would be happy to have cold cocked. That's harsh, Lennon.
You know, and one thing that does speaking of that, one thing about this movie that I think does work a little bit, I might be by accident, is that early on in the film, I was kind of rooting for Mickey Rourke, you know, because he's the main character. He gets away. Mm. You know, you're kind of like, ah, go get him, Mickey. He gets to this family's house and this family sucks. Like they're all fighting with each other. They hate each other. The dad's cheating and he's a low life and the kids are spoiled and the daughter's smarmy and all that stuff. And you're like, ah, you know, who cares if Mickey comes in and ruins their day? And Mickey's like, hey, make this phone call. Hey, I'm going to twirl the cord. Hey, you did such a good job. And you're like, kind of, you know, Mickey Rourke and the bad guys, you know, you're kind of like, all right with them. But by the end, the family does kind of come together as a unit, and Mickey is so crazy and over the top that you're like, ah, just put him down. He's a
exactly.
mad dog.
Yeah, that is true. I agree with that. But I can't take a lot of positives out of this film, only a lot of negatives. And another one I had a problem with was you and I, over our years, would have had turkey for dinner. Have you ever dressed in a tuxedo to eat a turkey? That fits you. That is somebody else's. That fits you perfectly.
Oh, I was going, man, it sure is nice that Mickey Rourke and Anthony Hopkins have the exact same measurements.
Even though Mickey Rourke's slightly taller than what Hopkins is.
Again, over the top. Hey, we need a dinner scene. Let's get Mickey in a tux. Let's get turkey.
Get Armani on the phone. I want one made up for Mickey. It's just ridiculous.
And then, like, Mickey's eating dinner. And then he's like, ah, I'm going to stab your hand but miss, like Bishop in Aliens.
Okay.
And
it
comes out of nowhere and it doesn't do anything. I don't know.
And the hand is perfectly spread on the table and Hopkins, who the knife is approaching, doesn't flinch. When anybody is bringing a knife towards you, your first action is defense. The defense mechanism, or the back away, or whatever. Not just stand there like this and hope, oh, I hope it doesn't hit my hand.
Well, and that scene is a perfect example of what's wrong with this movie, because like I said, there's no tension.
Mm-hmm.
It's like there are these mad criminals holding this family hostage, but we're going to have like a nice sit-down turkey dinner. You know, it just, it's weird. It's odd, you know, it kind of lets the air out of the tire a little bit in a way that doesn't service the movie. It's just kind of, you kind of go as a viewer, what are we doing here? Why are they having dinner? Why is Mickey Rourke like doing this bit with the knife and wearing his tux and get out of here? You know, it's dumb.
Yeah. Just stupid. And, but there were some genuinely good scenes as well when, Mimi Rogers is writing out that check for that guy who is at the guy at the front door.
Yeah.
The heating guy and Mickey Rourke, Bosworth, grabs it and she sees that she's written help us on the back of it. That was a good little thing. But I watched the theatrical trailer after I watched the film and everything is given away. Everything is given away in this. So you really could watch that trailer if you don't watch the film and you've got it. You know, apart from some of the more ridiculous things that we're mentioning here.
It's like a Robert Zemeckis film. Like every Robert Zemeckis movie, if you watch the trailer, it's the whole movie.
Yeah.
Like go and watch Castaway, Flight, The Polar Express, any Zemeckis film, you get the whole movie. I almost never see his movies in the theater, so I see a trailer and I go, okay.
Yep.
I saw it.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's two, like two and minutes. He said,
yeah.
And he said that's his philosophy. He goes, no, I think audiences want to know what they're getting beforehand.
That's like the new Megadeth album's coming out, thank God, in a month or so.
Oh, yeah.
Right? That's that'd be like Mustaine putting out a little snippet out there, and it's basically 30 seconds of each song. I don't want that. I wouldn't listen to it.
What do you think so far of the two tracks they put out?
I've heard one. I know there's a second one. I've deliberately not heard it. I've heard everyone rave about it. And I thought, I'm not going to fall into that trap that happened with The Darkness where I started hearing three and thought, oh I've got to stop.
Yeah.
I heard that first one they released. I'm like, oh man, I can't wait.
Yeah. No, I think this is going to be a banger. I think it's really good.
And I think it'll be their last one. So I think Mustaine knows it's the last one. He's just going to go out on a high with a complete speed metal album, you know, a la old Megadeth days.
And he's got a top class drummer too, Dirk Verbeeren from Soil.
You know. Yep. And Kiko as well on guitar.
Yeah, Kiko, who did a great job on Dystopia, you know.
Yeah.
Which was a solid Megadeth album, but this one sounds like, woof.
I've seen that guy pull off Chris Poland's parts Marty Friedman's like, it was nothing. It was just,
yeah,
he's awesome.
My that Dave, he knows how to pick him, you know.
He does. He might not be the easiest guy to get along with, but boy, he knows who he's, who he wants and who he gets.
Yeah. He doesn't pick losers, you know.
Nope.
But yeah, the Desperate Hours. Just some stuff I knew about this. Cimino basically was entering the Desperate Hours of his career at this point because the Sicilian did not turn out well for him, and he needed a job, and this was not a film that he necessarily wanted to make, but he was advised to, it was offered to him by Dino De Laurentiis because he did Year of the Dragon, I believe, for Dino.
Yeah.
And that turned out well. And so Dino offered it to him. He didn't want to do it, but I think he was advised, you need work, like take the job.
Yeah. And I will say, back in 1990 when I saw this, his name was still an attraction. Oh, it's a Michael Cimino film. Cool. I'll go see it. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, I'm a fan, but one character actor who shows up in this that I was like, I don't see him that much, but it's Gary or Jerry Bamman. He was, kids my age will remember him as Uncle Frank from Home Alone.
Real estate agent? The real estate agent?
Yeah, he was the real estate agent.
That was a, that was a weird scene. That was just strictly for that shot. That was a really well shot kill of the real estate agent where Mickey Rourke grabs the cushion in one swift move and then puts shoots him through it. Really well choreographed scene.
But yeah. Pointless. Really well choreographed. I think it's just in the movie to have him kill someone.
Yeah. Just to prove this guy is a killer. Because we don't see it. We don't see it until that. That this guy can basically grab someone he's known for 2 minutes and just, you know, snuff him out.
Yeah, because, you know, we keep hearing he's a killer. But he comes into this house and he's just kind of messing with them. And, you know, he doesn't really make good on any threats until he
blows away. No, he seems to be the sort of, you know, a guy who says, I'm going to do it. Basically, it's the boy cry wolf. Oh yeah, as you've said.
The guy who seems nuts is the David Morse character because he's the one who's constantly like going too far, beating up Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I know. But you can tell Hopkins was not having fun on this. I think if someone was to approach him and ask him, say, "Yeah, what? Can you give me your recollection on Desperate Hours? I hated it." That's probably what he'd say. He'll probably be, the Desperate Hours would probably be to him what Jaws 4 was to Michael Caine. I hated the film, but I liked the house that bought me, probably.
Well, you know what's funny is on Heaven's Gate, John Hurt was in the film, and he was supposed to be in it. He was only supposed to work a few days, but he ended up working for like weeks, maybe months on it.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was scheduled for a few days, he got overtime for all that extra shooting. And after he wrapped in time to shoot Elephant Man, which he said, I am done when Elephant Man starts because I'm not missing Elephant Man.
Yeah.
I'm working with David Lynch. And but he immediately went and bought a house and named it Overtime House.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Oh man. Speaking of Elephant Man, I just bought I bought the 4K of that a couple of years ago, and oh man, if you can get that on 4K, it looks stunning.
I'll bet. Fucking
incredible.
Yeah. But I'll bet.
Yeah. You were saying.
We were talking about Anthony Hopkins. Yeah, you can tell he's not enjoying himself. His performance is terrible in this film, I think. It's really sweaty, manic, wide-eyed. Like you said, his accent, it's kind of like
it wavers.
So way wavers back and forth. You can't tell if he wants to do an American or a Welsh accent. What did you think of Rourke in the film?
As you said, very Brando-ish. He came across as very Brando in The Godfather, you know, with the jaw.
He's acting with his chin a lot.
Yeah, his chin a lot.
Notice that? Like, he's always like he's got his teeth out, you know, he's kind of acting with his hair and his chin.
Yeah. Don't try anything funny.
Don't try anything funny. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, I think my favorites in the film are the henchmen, Wally and Albert. I think they're fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't care much for the Shawnee Smith character of May, the daughter. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I said, I was a fan of hers from The Blob. But yeah, she came across as a real bitch in this one.
Yeah, not a very likable. Like this was when kids started to be really unlikable in movies.
Obnoxious,
when they started to be,
yeah.
Like smarmy.
Yeah.
But you know, what about Mimi Rogers? What'd you think of her?
She was fine. You know, didn't really do much except stand there and look good being Mimi Rogers. Didn't really.
You know, yeah, and I kind of, one thing I want to give her props for is she didn't, I don't recall her going as crazy with the role as Mickey and Anthony were.
No.
Because eventually it becomes who can be the biggest, loudest actor.
Yeah.
And I don't remember her really doing that. If she did, she didn't do it as well.
No, she doesn't do it. It's basically left to you know, the two guys in the room, you know, who's got the bigger dick in the room sort of attitude.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
But you know, positives for this movie, I think it does a good job with the character arcs with flipping who your sympathy is for.
Yep.
I think the movie looks great. Like the cinematography is slick.
Yep.
The editing is slick. Apparently, I'm seeing on here that Peter Hunt, the Bond editor who directed Honor Majesty's Secret Service, worked on this.
Yep.
But the movie is really over the top. It's really big. And I don't think that tone works for a chamber piece, which this is. But it kind of wants to be bigger than that. You can tell Cimino doesn't want to do a chamber piece. He wants to do something more epic, and it kind of hurts the movie, I think.
Apparently it was fiddled with in post-production quite a bit, and a bit of stuff taken out. I mean, a lot of filmmakers say, oh, it's not my vision. And okay, but, you know, go back, give us your vision of it. Well, you can't now, obviously. He's gone. But you had 25 years before he died to go back and work with the elements that you had, but you never did.
Well, you know, who knows if you want to. Like, I don't think he really cared too much about this movie.
Mm.
You know, I think apparently it took a lot of convincing for Criterion to get him to restore Heaven's Gate. Because he was like, I don't want to do it. It's too painful. You know, it's just, it's a big pain in my life. But eventually he was like, you know what? I'm going to do it. And he went in and restored it. But apparently it was difficult to get him to do it.
Hopefully Criterion can influence Michael Mann for The Keep, which I don't hold much hope for that.
No. But yeah, getting the man cut of The Keep would be great. But unfortunately, the problem with The Keep is the guy who did the special effects died before he could do them. So it was like, it was kind of a cluster. It's kind of like that Wes Craven movie, Cursed. You know, there's a lot of like, people have been like, oh, when are we going to get Wes Craven's version of Cursed, you know, before he died? But they were like, well, that first version he shot, it's just unfinished. Like, we can't, you know, and we can't really do anything with it unless we do something unless we shot new stuff, which we're not going to do.
Why didn't we get George Romero's version of Bruiser, man? It could have been such a better film.
Was that one that got gutted, Bruiser?
I think so, but holy shit, it was bad.
Yeah,
so
that's the one with
bad.
The misfits in it, right? That's the
Yeah, that's the only good point of it. Bullerus is just awful.
Hey, Romero's video for their song Scream was pretty fun.
It was. I agree. It was a lot of fun.
But yeah, probably. I remember watching Bruiser and just kind of, it felt like one of those kind of cheap, when those kind of 80s, 70s, 80s horror guys. I remember around the like late 90s, early aughts, they were kind of slumming it with pieces like that.
Kind of cheap DVD. That period was a real dark period of
horror films, which I will say has horror has finally resurged itself with one film, The Black Phone. I thought was
Black
fucking
incredible. Yeah,
fucking incredible. I held no expectations for it when I sat down and watched it. I remember my 16-year-old saying, "Oh, Dad, it's a blummy ass film. It won't be very good." I said, "Oh, yeah. Well, I got zero expectations." 100 minutes later, I said, "That is the best horror film I've seen in about 20 years, easily."
Yeah. I went to see it with my wife on a date night, you know, after we had our daughter, you know, we managed to get our ducks in a row to go out to see a movie, and we had a lot of fun with it.
Mm.
You know, and I like Scott Derrickson, the director. I think when he's doing horror films, you know, he's in the pocket when he's doing stuff like that. You know, I was pretty disappointed with his foray into Marvel movies with Doctor Strange.
But
you know, that's just Marvel, I think, strangles talent, and I think he's better off doing stuff like this.
Yeah. The Black Phone was, I said to myself after I watched it, that is the film Rob Zombie wishes he could make. He wishes he had the talent to write something like that or get his hands on that property and make it. But then again, if he had it made, he probably would have screwed it right up. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, thankfully he didn't.
And I liked how Black Phone, you know, it is very like, there's a lot of Stephen King-y type stuff in there. Cause it's written
very much. Yeah.
But it's not as drawn out as King likes to do. You know, I think it's just kind of distilled to its bones. And it's a really good movie. And as Garrow said, Garrow goes, "This movie's about how Stephen King's a horrible dad." And I went, he's probably right. Like the mask kind of looks like Stephen King that Ethan Hawke's wearing.
Yeah. That'll be that mask that Ethan Hawke's wearing will be one of those ones that's added years down the track to a Freddy and a Jace, a recognizable one. Oh, that's the Black Phone that Ethan Hawke. I hope they don't ruin these films with sequels. You know, with copycats. You know, of the grabber as a copycat now as someone else has taken over that thing and don't ruin it.
Did you see Sinister?
No.
Go, check out Sinister. See what you think.
Okay.
It's the same director, same writers. Ethan Hawke, the guy who plays Charlie, the guy with the mustache who's doing cocaine, trying to solve the crime. He's in it.
Oh, okay.
It's a lot of the same people. I was impressed by that, and I remember hearing the sequel sucked, and I even liked the sequel, which they produced, but they didn't direct it. But I remember thinking even that was pretty good. All right.
I will see it. I'll definitely watch
it. If you liked Black Phone, check out
Sinister. Oh, yeah, very much. Very much. But, oh, man, is there anything else about Desperate Hours we can talk about?
I think that's it. You know, I want to check out the Bogart one. And I need to finish my Michael Cimino filmography by seeing Sun Chaser. I need to revisit Deer Hunter. It's been so long. But as far as the movies I have seen, I think this is the weakest one that I've seen of his. I don't know what you think about that, but you know, I'd give it probably a 4 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you see it cause you like Cimino and you just want to see all his movies. But, I think as a thriller, you know, you could do a lot better.
If you're delving into Cimino's filmography, do not start with this one.
No. Start with, like, you know, people are going to start with The Deer Hunter, probably.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of his first movie, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
Oh, yeah, I got that on Blu-ray. I like that one.
And it's a few fun. Other, you know, he was working as a screenwriter. He co-wrote Magnum Force for Clint Eastwood.
Oh, so he did. Film. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and apparently what happened was, so Michael Cimino's agent was at the same agency as Clint's agent. And Cimino's agent said, "Why don't you write something for Clint, you know, and I'll get it to him." And he wrote Thunderbolt and Lightfoot. And Eastwood liked it, but he said, "I've got something else for you. I have this script for Magnum Force. It's about 40 pages done. It was written. John Milius started it, and then got the offer to do Dillinger and left. And Clint was generous to, like, Clint, he left with Clint's blessing, but he gave the script to Cimino to finish. So Cimino wrote the rest of it.
Hmm.
And then as a reward, he got to direct Thunderbolt and Lightfoot for Clint. But one thing I thought was interesting was the book said that Thunderbolt and Lightfoot really didn't, directing that didn't help his career, because Clint's directors tended to stay in Clint's house. Like, you didn't direct a Clint Eastwood film and suddenly become an auteur, you know? Mm. Like, that became sort of looked at that way after Deer Hunter and all that.
Yeah.
But it said that doing that film didn't really do much to advance his career, because doing a Clint Eastwood movie, those movies were more associated with Clint than whoever was directing, like Buddy Van Horn or James, you know, James Fargo or whatever. Nobody cares, you know.
But you were in that peak era as well of Eastwood. You had his Dirty Harry films, Dirty Harry, Magnum Force, then you had Outlaw Josie Wales. So it was sort of really meshed in with those other bigger pictures out there.
Well, And what's funny is people go, how could a guy with a reputation for being a perfectionist like Cimino work with someone like Clint? But, you know,
Clint had more clout. Clint had more say. He had basically control over Cimino.
And Clint also showed that he had no problem firing fussy directors when he fired Philip Kaufman on Outlaw Josie Wales.
Mm.
And so apparently Cimino just worked swiftly, and anytime he tried to go a little further, Clint would just go, "Ah, we're done," you know. So,
we're done.
But a couple of other movies Cimino wrote. He worked on Silent Running as a writer.
Okay. The
Douglas Trumbull film.
Yeah.
And his name isn't on this, but the author of the book said it's his script. Like the credited authors, it's WGA nonsense. He's The Rose with Bette Midler, that Janis Joplin.
I've seen it.
But not Janet. That, apparently the script is all his stuff. His name's not on it, but it's his script.
I actually remember that being a good film. It was a long time ago. I didn't care much about Bette Midler, but I remember The Rose being really decent film.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
One I'd like to revisit, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got the Criterion Blu-ray of it.
Of course you do.
Of course. Mm. But yeah, what would you give Desperate Hours out of 10?
I'd give it a 3. That's the best I could give it. It was pretty low.
Pretty low. But as when you were 18, it was good, right?
Oh, when I was 18, it was probably, you know, 7.5. Probably about that.
Yeah.
8, maybe. Because it was, you know, it was all masculinity. You know, there's girls. There's, you know, there's car chases and, not car chases, but, you know, the car, you know, going through the desert and Kelly Lynch coming out of the car. So, yeah, it was
Kelly
all.
Kelly Lynch.
Yeah, yeah. It was
Kelly
all
Lynch's legs. Like, every shot is like,
yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, I was like, man, Mike Cimino is obsessed with her. Like, you know,
yeah.
he is
to Kelly Lynch's legs what Tarantino is to feet. He's just obsessed. Oh, yeah. With, yeah. I mean, them some nice legs out of film. He could do a lot worse. So, yeah, 3 from me, my friend. This, yeah, not one I'd recommend. As you said, if you want to be a completist with Cimino's filmography, go ahead, watch it. Don't expect a great deal. And you might be maybe surprised, you know, that you may like it a little bit. I don't think so.
The only other crowd I would recommend it to would be the people who like hammy Mickey Rourke performances, because those people are out there, the cult of Mickey Rourke.
You know? Yeah. Like, what was that one I saw? Johnny Handsome was around this time. Yeah. That was around 89, I think it was. Mm-hmm. There's one more. I keep forgetting the name of it. It was around that time as well. One Mickey Rourke film I really do like is The Pope of Greenwich Village he did with Eric Roberts.
Yeah. Another one Cimino was attached to, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Didn't mind that one. Again, one I haven't seen for many years, so it would be one I have to pop into the old player.
That'd be one to revisit for sure. That one was a flop, but it had a cult. It has a cult following.
There is a good film I got sent by Nez, who you'll be hearing shortly with his piece, of course, on DVD. I did watch it on VHS way the hell back when, called King of the Gypsies, with Eric Roberts. Mm-hmm. Shelley Winters, and that woman from Ghostbusters 2. I keep forgetting her name. The one who plays the secretary.
Annie Potts.
Annie Potts. That's it. Yeah, yeah. And it's basically about a band of gypsies who and... yeah, it's been a long ass time since I've seen the film. But I remember watching that going, yeah, I really like that film.
Didn't different. Robert Duvall do a movie about gypsies?
Possibly. He's not in this one, though.
He didn't direct it, did he? I remember hearing he did a movie about gypsies.
No, don't think it was this one. We'll have to look it up. But I brought it up before, where there was an interview with Shelley Winters on, it may have been Carson, I think. And Annie Potts was also on the couch or on the seat next to her. So it must have been after Ghostbusters, I imagine. And they were talking, and Shelley Winters goes, oh, it was nice to meet you. And Annie Potts goes, we did a film together, King of the Gypsies. And she goes, I don't remember that one. Yeah, that was funny.
The Robert Duvall film I'm thinking of is Angelo, My Love.
Oh, right. I know of it. I've never seen it, though. Is that 84, that one?
83.
83, okay. Yeah, 83. Right, yeah. All right. Well, I think that's it for us. Yeah. We are, not today, but we're going to get cracking very shortly, getting these Munsters episodes recorded and up and about. Just be warned, guys, that coming towards the end of August, there may not be some content because we're going to be really busy getting these Munsters ones done, because I'm actually going away for a week towards the tail end of September, so I really need to get these up, recorded, and onto the YouTube and Podbean servers scheduled for release. So if there's nothing around the end of August from us, understands, because we're focusing on the September releases. But there will be still stuff coming. Obviously, this one, there'll be one after this, and maybe one more, but we are really focusing on the Munsters stuff because they're going to be pretty epic. We got a lot to cover in there.
Yeah. I might crank out some random content to just keep
there you go. Going. There you go. Just to keep the channel ticking over, I guess. Yeah. But as for me, the first episode I did on my mini run over at Watch This Movie is out, where Wolfie and I spoke about a bunch of films. Recently seen
about
ones.
Did you guys talk about the great artist Fred Durst?
We did. We spoke about The Fanatic in quite a lengthy discussion.
The album is awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't mind The Fanatic. It was a better film than it should have been. Mm-hmm. It had no right being as good as it was.
You know, Fred's movies do have their fans. There are people who say Education of Charlie Banks is a good movie. I couldn't get into it, but hey.
Yeah.
You know?
The Fanatic is good because it's carried by John Travolta. John Travolta was really, really good in this. It was a really daring movie.
He looks like he committed to that role. And, you know, Travolta, when he commits to a role, even if it sucks, it's entertaining.
Yeah.
You know?
I liked it. Is it something I'll watch every couple of years? Probably not. Something I'll watch again? Yeah, because I think there's more in there I'd like to see. So we did that. Then the next episode that we've already recorded was a 3.5-hour episode on Repo Man. It just went on and on and on. So when I told Mulder, he was very diplomatic and said, oh, yeah, no worries. I'm sure he's probably thinking, oh, Jesus Christ, 3.5 hours I got to cut. So, yeah. I'll be doing this two recorded. There'll be one more I'm doing later next week, I believe. And I think that might be my run done there. And I'm obviously back here until Mulder's back. So, yeah, go over to Watch This Movie. Give those guys a listen. Give them a follow. Give them everything. Go support them. They're good guys. If you like the MMC, you're going to like them. They analyze films a bit more different than we do. They're a bit more in-depth than we are. We jump about the timelines and then go off on rants about Rob Zombie and Megadeth and whatever else is, you know, catching our eyes or ears of that week. But they're
a little
pretty
more
much
spastic, yeah.
bit more like that. But give them a listen and go show them some love. Give them a subscription. I think you'll
be more than pleased with them. But yeah,
and
that's
Pat,
us
if you
done.
Want to support our show, how do we support the show?
Yes, about to get into that. We've got a Ko-fi page, a donation page for us. Shout out to this week's donators who are recurring donators. So thank you to Cecil Birch and thank you to Trent Reynolds for their monthly donations that they give, which you can do. The link for it will be below, where you can do a recurring monthly donation of a few bucks. It's up to you what you want to donate. Or you can do a one-off if you want to help the show out. It's the donations we've gotten have really been helping out. We're getting things, you know, paid off and whatnot, and we can just not have to worry about financial pressures. You're now a new father. You know, I've got kids all over the place. You know, John's a parent. So we've got costs. And as I said, with us coming up to, hey, this month, Hunter, August is 12 years since we started doing this. I think in mid-August.
That's nuts.
It's insane. Nuts. When we did the Rob Zombie Halloween commentary, the first thing we ever did, yeah. ever.
Which it's was, all starts, all roads lead back to Rob.
There you go. We started with Rob Zombie. And we shit on the man, but we always come back to Rob Zombie. So.
If he stops making movies, we have to pack it in. You know.
Yeah, it's an idea. But I don't think it's going to happen. He's the little engine that could. He just doesn't know how to give up.
Yeah. You know,
and what was he blocking people on social media who was shit
canning
the trailer?
People were dogpile. People were dragging him on Instagram about his trailer, and he was blocking people left and right.
That's just pathetic. Come on, man, you're in the public eye.
It's
you're
the internet,
filming.
Man. Don't step into the arena if you can't take it.
No, don't do that. Don't go there. But I thought that was really funny when I heard. I think you mentioned it that he was blocking people. I thought that's just juvenile. As juvenile as he is and his films is. Actually, speaking of that real quick before we go, I was watching a five worst singers who can no longer hold, who've lost their voice video on YouTube somewhere. And I knew about Bon Jovi. I was actually expecting Don Dokken because his voice is shot.
Dude, you know Vince Neil is like, thank you, Bon Jovi, for taking the heat off of me.
Vince Neil was in that top five as well, though. So he was there. Bon Jovi. Don Dokken was not mentioned, but the number one pick was Rob Zombie. I thought, didn't know his
really?
Voice. Yeah.
I thought he'd always just kind of done like, I didn't think what he did was that demanding. So
no.
Anybody would notice.
So what does that tell you if he's been picked as the number one in this content creator's
weird
opinion?
You know, but I haven't seen him live in years, so who knows? Maybe it's taken a downturn.
Yeah. Yeah, that latest album of Zombies from last year, boy, I was disappointed. It started off so well. I thought, wow, this sounds like a white zombie, and then it just descended into shit.
I feel like every album he does, there's a moment where I'm like, ooh, okay, maybe, you know, maybe this is it, and then it just kind of doesn't gel, you know. I feel like that's kind of been the trend lately.
You could probably take the last three or four Rob Zombie albums, cherry-pick the best ones, and make a really...
You could have a solid white zombie album by cherry picking from those.
Yeah, Dave Mustaine will say to her, hey, Rob, listen to this new Megadeth. This is how you do it. You do it all in one big hit. Fingers
all you
got to
do is do an Alice Cooper impression like me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, you know, John said I'm doing the Alice Cooper press. I went, of course.
Mm.
I never thought of that. He's doing Alice Cooper. That's crazy.
Yeah, of course.
No.
Why would you not? Anyway. All right, mate. We're going to call it quits from here. Stick around for the NES. I have not heard what Anthony sent me. He only got it to me yesterday, so who knows? But I'm missing those Boris Johnson rants at the end. But, hey, you know, time to move on. And
There will be some other British politician that he hates that he can...
I'm sure Liz Truss, if she gets the nod as the next PM, will incur the wrath of the NES. Sure. All right. On that note, I'm going to say, see you later.
Adios.
And now it's time for Rue Britannia with your foreign correspondent, the NES.
Thank you. In a move that will surprise never the avid and dozy think that Kamala Harris can tie her in shoelaces, the Commonwealth Games finally got underway this week in Birmingham. Birmingham, the home of really unsuccessful football clubs, provisional IRA pub bombings, crossroads, Asian sweatshops, ethnic immigrant problems, and worst of all, Lenny Henry. In the words of novelist Jane Austen, quote-unquote, Birmingham is not a place to promise much. One has no great hopes of Birmingham. I always say there is something direful in the sound. I concur. Anyway, once the Guild Fest constituting the Diversity Fest, which constituted the opening ceremony, it was down to action. Bowling, women's cricket, paraplegic lawn jumping, javelin throwing in wheelchairs, and the usual woke CRGT arguments about where the transgenders should shower. My advice? Let them stay out in the open and pray for rain. Birds and the Women's England football team handed a faux victory to their feminist handlers by winning the European Women's Football Championship this week. No non-binaries were involved, no transgenders, no mindbenders, no Milo mindbenders, no redsetters, no bedwetters. Just good quality, good old-fashioned, top-quality traditional English minge. Sadly, reality being non-woke CRGT had had to creep in to spoil the dream. The team lesbian being asked how she felt about sharing with her teammates. Personally, I wouldn't have a problem with it myself, but only if I were using a bar of Imperial Leather Soap, the type of soap that removes criminal-related DNA. Anyway, the team captain wore a rainbow armband when the England men's team are scheduled to actually wear the very same rainbow LGBT armband when they play in the World Cup in Qatar in November. Qatar banning homosexuality. As well as also the usual complaints concerning low TV ratings and half-empty stadiums during the tournament. Not so much Free Lions, but Free Irons, and don't forget to put a good crease in my Levi's 501s, love. Pickles. And Prince Charles got into a right jar of them this week as his charity, the Prince's Trust, was exposed as yet again as a slush fund for illegal donations from very dodgy Arabs indeed. Which to say all of them. That's bad as illegal enough. Though even here, Charles may have gone a bit too far by taking donations from two members of the Bin Laden family. What a carve-up. At this point, Clarence House went into the usual default setting, which is to say, deny everything. Which is just as well, since the Arab donations are now mounting up. Aside from the two Bin Ladens, there was also the matter of a Saudi tycoon who made a donation in return for a knighthood and a UK passport, a former Kremlin banker who made a donation and whose money mysteriously vanished, and a Qatari sheikh who handed over £500,000 in a suitcase in the hotel room to Charles's middleman. By comparison, John Gotti and Roy Demere made their money the old-fashioned way. They'd kill for it. Talk about a runaway prince. But then again, do you know where your heir to the throne is tonight? Finally, further notes in passing, Evita Peron's sparkle struggles to explain how she lied about being an only child in her interview with Oprah Winfrey. Not like she doesn't have a half-sister or an estranged, physically ill father or anything. BBC woke hackette Emmett Barnett goes full editorial tonto when she asks a black female footballer why the England women's football team, why is it that they're not called the Free Lions like their male counterparts? It's because they're basically called Free Lionesses. A clear indication as regarding why it is that BBC identitarian woke presenters must never go full tonto on anything. New Tory leader Liz Truss vows to pass legislation criminalising wolf whistling as misogyny. She won't be around for long as Prime Minister, but then again her vagina certainly wasn't. And the mansion once owned by serial killers Ronnie and Reggie Cray goes on the open market for £2.25 million, complete with human remains buried in the palatial garden, bloodstains on the ceiling, and punch marks on the living room walls to indicate just where Ronnie's most romantic tendencies tended to manifest. A rural countryside retreat for a pair of mass-murdering village idiots who loved dear old Mum and Barbara Windsor. The twins agreed. Quote unquote, we loved living there, said Reggie behind bars. Quote unquote, I'm going to fucking cut you up like a Sunday joint of beef, said Ronnie. Behind bars. Pax.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com.
For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.